You were saying that submarines popped up behind you?
Behind the convoy.
Behind the convoy?
Yes, I did. Yes. They were usually picked up by the ship's radar. But they only popped up at night. And we left them to the escort. Because although we had flown at night, it was a pretty dicey job flying off this little carrier at night. So I don't remember us doing any night flying operations.
May I ask, how vulnerable were you to attack? Surely to get rid of the ship that was flying the aircraft would be number one objective of the U-boats.
Well, they went for the convoys, and they went for the front room. There's no doubt about that. They got ahead of the convoy. It was our general rule. By the time we got there in early 43, they had started their wolf pack concept, which meant that they were calling on their frequencies other submarines. And this gave them away, long time before they realized that we were picking up their transmissions. And therefore, as the Commodore did, he used to move the whole blinking convoy. They were all by simple maneuvers for the ships to follow, such as I think it was 30 degrees to port or 30 degrees to starboard. And if you did one 30 degrees to port, you want to go further that way, you did another. That was by very, very simple light signals. So that was the Commodore's effort to get away from where a submarine had gone and signal its presence. And by day, we would follow up that direction. And they'd done so once or twice and found submarines on the surface. And the first thing they did, this is early 43, so it's February or March, they would dive. But come about April, I can't remember the exact dates, I'm sorry, one, if not two of our aircraft were surprisingly shot down. And the crews not recovered. So, at one place, we had these fighters on board, a specific purpose of shooting up U-boats on the surface and theoretically leaving it clear for the soldiers to attack, and I took part in two attacks later. And that put the confidence back in our aircrew, because when you went out on a long patrol, you wouldn't take them for that, because the fighters had a very short endurance.
What was a fighter's? This would be a Seafarer, wouldn't it?
No, actually, it was a Martinet.
A Martinet?
An American Martinet.
Right.
I think they called it a Wildcat, or one of us called it a Wildcat, the other a Martinet. A single engine radio, a beautiful little airplane, with American 0.5 guns, four in front. And we could beat up the submarine very effectively. The crew who were sitting on deck. And that generally put the submarine down, which happened in two cases, and I went and dropped depth charges. And I can't remember which months, but then we were re-equipped. We came back to England with a little bit more training, a fortnight's training, with rockets. 3-inch unguided rockets. The guide came from the aircraft firing room. Just like, you know, the aircraft had your own sights to do that. And these were very effective, but it wasn't my carrier. Paradoxically, it was a carrier called the Archer, which is the same class as us. They sank a U-boat on the surface with these rockets. And that put the wind out the Germans, because they recalled, and so I got the months right, but they certainly recalled all their U-boats from the Atlantic. And suddenly the Atlantic was clear to us. And I think the last operation I did, when I said operation means going with the convoy, but going back was in August 1943, I never saw a single U-boat. Really became a bit of a yawn. And we had gone down south, where also they gave the transmitters that they were down south, but even we couldn't find any. We were right down to the Azores. We were really looking for them then. And it says in the book, This is when the tables were turned. We went into the attack instead of purely defensive. And for my own personal thing, I'd then been flying for 2 years. I crashed in the sea once, I got shot down once, and I bailed out of a sea fire, so I thought it was time I gave it up, which was heartily agreed by the ship's doctor. It sounds funny, but no, on board the ship, if you know what I mean, it does sound like a sad story, but I noticed the stoker coming up on the flight deck whenever I was flying. I mean, he may have come out at other times, and he'd be sitting in the sidewalk, you know, along just below the deck there, and he always just pops his head up when I got out of my aircraft, which was ahead of the bell in the front, and said, "You've done it again." So I once said to him, "Why do you come here?" He said, "Look, I am the double bottom stoker. Do you know what the DB stoker is? He's the one who's sent down in the bowels of the ship to clean out all the rubbish, because you don't ship it out by day, you only ship it out by night." And he was this man, normally given to somebody under punishment. But he said, as long as I could come up and see the aircrew, I felt I was in the war. Well, it's sweet, obviously.
Yes.
And he was always there. I can remember him just looking over the flight deck, you know, I was getting out of the aircraft and thought, DB Stoker. But that was what he felt. And I think that's true of the whole ship. We hadn't, otherwise, they hadn't got any action. But we did have some 5-inch guns in case we picked up with something on the surface, but that never occurred. What they liked to see and talk to. And the stoker, second class, was the lowest form of animal life. But as long as he had a few words of the aircrew, he was happy. I mean, that's a tearjerker, but that's absolutely true, you see. When you talk about the ship was a converted merchant room, and the officers were there for R&R, all they were there. And the ship was converted from an ordinary merchant room. That was pretty comfortable, rather slow.
Slow what speed, John?
Well, I think its maximum speed was 17 knots. And we certainly had to crack up to that to get us off if we had that 9-knot torpedo on board. Once the times we were short of wind, and just come on, and so we had to drain out the petrol. Oh, very, very dodgy, but very carefully worked out.
And did you still have 3 crew?
Yes, I'll be careful about this, because when we were operating from England, we dropped the air gunner and replaced him with an overload tank. But when we were on the carrier, no, I think we had the crew of 3 all the time. I certainly don't remember carrying an overload tank.
What was the air gunner's function then?
He was a wireless operator. And the air gunner, I mean, he had a little gun. But so he remained the wireless operator. And highly trained. Short title TAG, Telegraphic Mist Air Gunner.
And then in the middle sat the radar operator, really, or?
Navigating, yes. Observer, called the observer.
But he was a navigator stroke radar operator.
That's right, and he was an observer, but he was called the observer. And he was commissioned like me in the RMVR. And we depended very much on them to get us back to the carriers.
And you were at the front?
I was at the front, that's right. I'd say another incident, you may not leave it in, but we were rather startled. We lost 2 aircraft on our way to America. And we got their last message, which was ditching alongside merchantmen, but there was a code for this, you see. Ditching alongside merchantmen, and then of course hush. And we wondered what had happened to them. We completed our convoy to the east and then turned around and came back to England, and about 3 weeks or 4 weeks later, there were the aircrew on the jetty on the Clyde. And they got back to England 3 weeks before us, and do you know who picked them up? Queen Mary. Now that is a dream. I mean, Queen Mary is not allowed to stop. She stopped and picked up this aircrew, and I thought that's a real tearjerker.
So they ditched next to the Queen Mary?
Yes, they did. And the Queen Mary stopped and picked them up. Luckily, they were well west and off the Labrador coast. So you asked me about relations between us. And so it happens in my little village here, you may not want to repeat this, there is a merchant navy captain retired. And he told me before the convoy set out, there was a convoy conference. And when we heard there was an escort carrier, we all cheered. So that's a nice little touch that's come around. Fargoff, the Labrador ghost, was a real menace. Because you couldn't see the Don, he was usually below your flying height. And I can remember turning back to the carrier, and the carrier was totally and completely invisible, and I could see 60 yards, a condition under which you could never possibly land on. But I did it by very careful navigation on the ASV, picked up the wake from the ship, turned sharp left, and got on. And the captain came down to the flight deck and said, "I'm really glad to have you back." And then it kept right down, we didn't do any more flying. You won't forget an event like that, because in the fog in the Atlantic. So those sort of things wound you up a little bit. I wasn't conscious of being wound up, I thought it was all part of the course. And this was redeemed by an admiral travelling on a train with me. And he asked me how many aircraft I'd crashed, and I told him, he said, "Well, I did twice that number." And I did, and the CI said, "Yes. Did you hear those propellers turning?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, I did." Can you imagine it? He said, "Did you get lost?" I said, "It's in the fog." He said, "How do you get back on board?" Well, I did it by doing a great one turn until I saw the carrier, shut down the engine, and I was over the carrier and landed on. He said, "Oh, I did that twice." It was part of the course.
When you use the expression wound up, would it be correct to sort of interpret from that the stress and the strain of doing what you're doing was slowly ratcheting up or rather I should say diminishing your ability to do your job effectively?
Yes, I would say that, and I really believe subsequently taken off flying 2 or 3 years later, but that was the way the doctor would sum it up. It happened to be he was a young lieutenant in the ship, but he was also an air specialist. And he realised I'd reached this point. I knew I wouldn't do some operation in this little seaplane, which I was required. It wasn't an operation, it was only to clip the mail. And I reckoned the ship, I might not get back to the ship. He said, "Right, you're off, lad."
What made you think that?
Well, it was a long way. I was on my own, and I mean on my own, I didn't even have an observer, I had a wireless operation. And I had to fly back to the ship where I knew where it was supposed to be. A long way from somewhere in the Greek islands. Somewhere like Rhodes, look at the map on the way back to Malta, somewhere like 500 miles, which is about, in that plane, about 5 hours flying. Well, I hadn't got 5 hours fuel in the first place. And the plane was halfway between the two. It's all right thing, you can't miss Malta. Well, I did it once before, I couldn't miss Sicily, and then turn left to find Malta, but I hadn't got the confidence to take the risk.
And when would that have been, this incident?
That was it was 46 or 47.
Oh, right.
I'd been in the ship then for 2 years.
Of course.
And I flew this seaplane.
Yes.
Which otherwise was great fun. I'd done my conversion course. You asked about this. I think all pilots who had trained in 1940, which I had, were re-scrubbed, given another checkout to bring them up to date with RT procedures, landing procedures, and flying a fast monoplane type, which the Seafire was, and Duster, instead of the Swordfish, which couldn't even go half the speed of the Seafire. And you were retrained, and I was retrained. What was called single monoplane type. But I had an accident as well.
Yes. 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 Before we move on then to your conversion to flying Seafires, Is there anything else that you feel that you'd like to add to, in, by way of any description or of your period flying Swordfish, especially in the Atlantic? Anything at all?
I was very conscious in the Atlantic that you might not get back all the time. And I said, for really well poor reasons, the two aircraft which were lost and that picked up by the Queen Mary, they hadn't actually lost themselves, they gave up the effort. And I think that affected the doctor's mind. They suddenly felt desperate, and then actually, Labrador wasn't far away, they could have got there. But this was a sign of cracking, if you like. And one of the pilots I knew quite well, I was also the batsman, the squadron batsman, the ship had its own and didn't need to practice. And I thought he was very bad and very shaky, and he was going to kill himself before long. This particular pilot,
yes.
He killed himself. It's true, but he didn't expect that. But that was all part of it, I think. Yes, I was very confident in my flying ability. I think I was, I believe I was, a very good and responsible pilot. And this confidence remained with me when I knew I'd have to go back to general service, by the way, to pursue my career, because my commission had been converted from Army R to full career, if you like. And I think I mentioned this before, that a list came out every 6 months saying who had been accepted. And I'll admit that most of them were accurate, because the Navy had very few regular aircrew. So there I was, accepted as a regular aircrew, past my destroyer command, and therefore I had a reasonable platform for general service. And therefore I went to two frigates in good succession.
But before we get there, John, I think that you converted to CFARs.
Yes, I had.
Because I don't think that you have described yet in detail the incident which ultimately where you had to jump out of one.
Yes, I was actually in the Triumph carrier at the time, which I joined in 46 or 47. So it must have been in early 47 that the ship was visiting Rosyth and the naval air station nearby. I had already converted at Leon 7, and not a very conventional course. And I was fast for landing and taking off on the land. I hadn't started the ticket. But when we got to the site, the commander there said, "You've got to keep your hand in at flying seafarers." So he sent me ashore to another Griffin, which was a naval air station there, and go and do some flying. And I flew the seafarer in the morning, and I flew again in the afternoon. I had this accident in the afternoon. So I was just keeping my hand in.
So immediately you started to fly CFARs at Rosyth?
Yes.
Per the Air Officer Commanding's instruction?
Yes.
You had this accident?
Yes.
Yeah. And how many hours had you had on CFARs prior to that?
I would say 15 at the very most.
So you were whilst you had, I think you told me once, 1,500 hours on Swordfish.
Yes.
So you were a massively experienced pilot. You were inexperienced on this particular type.
Yes, that's quite true. I'd done quite a lot at Leon 7 as part of the course. And then a couple of days at Donny Bristol while the ship was refitting or something, not doing very much, at Donny Bristol. It was during that period. I was very close to the question when I was in my hospital bed as how this had happened. I couldn't really count it myself, which was a bad sign. But I couldn't account for it, yeah.
Can you talk me through what happened that day, then?
Well, I started having phone conference in the morning, in the afternoon, I started doing one or two aerobatics. I'm a pension height there, 20,000 feet. In one of these aerobatics, whatever I was doing, I went into a spin. which I calculated correctly, and you corrected it correctly, and I got out of the split. I was still very high, and you get out of the split, and you come up to your operating height. And when I got to that height, with no encouragement from me, it went into another spin. And that happened 3 times. I corrected properly and came up to proper height, and immediately the plane, as far as I was concerned, tipped itself over into another spin. And I thought 3 times was enough. And I was now down to about 6,000 feet, and I couldn't afford it again. So as I came out of the spin, I put the stick over and released the straps.
And you open the canopy? Open the.
I had to release the hood of it.
Yes, the hood.
First, you can't get into the door. And I went out just by kicking the stick forward. That's how I got out. And this was listened to very intently about how I got out of it. But I said, I cannot account for the fact that the plane went back into the spin not once, not twice, but 3 times. And the old story from the sea fight pilot is, if you want to get out of the sea fight, don't touch anything. which I said at the time, well, I wanted to get this plane back. In fact, I called up the Abbeys and said, I'm coming in, I've got something wrong. And that was it.
Now, just before we come to the investigation as to what happened, you injured yourself on the way out, I think.
Judging by the wounds I got, I injured myself on the way out. Yes. And it's about where the door handle is. Well, it might have been the throttle. The throttle, which had on it then a gun sight control, sat right out here. And I was opened up from here. I'm not going to show you now, sorry. Right down to there.
And that's from your hip bone right down your left leg?
Yes.
Down your shin?
Yes.
Mm. Right.
And it was either the door or it was the gun sight controller.
Yes.
Oh, it was on the throttle, you see?
Yes.
And that used to control the gun sight. So it was one of those. I didn't bother to look, actually.
When, at the end of the investigation, was a reason proffered by the authorities as to what might have happened?
They did include the possibility of the trim on the aircraft being wrong. I can't remember which way. They said, we have had this experience once before, which relieved me immensely. So I thought I was a good pilot. That's terrible frustration to have this.
What is the trim, John?
It's to accentuate the attitude of the aeroplane for landing and taking off. You round the trim back, and that brings the tail down very quickly, or the nose level, if you want it that way. And that you did in the cockpit.
With a wheel, I suppose.
Something very simple like
yes.
this. It was fixed. I mean, you pushed it, put the trim forward, and brought up this extra flap on the tail. It wasn't going to move itself. It's remotely possible that I trimmed it incorrectly, but that's very unlikely, because I've been a done out of bags for about 5 minutes anyway. And they were curious to know whether this could have happened. I said, well, Jim, I'm glad to hear it wasn't my fault. I was still in hospital at the time. They're very careful not to press me too hard.
Yes.
I went back to fly. I re-scrubbed again without actually flying free fire. I went on to Harvard, and eventually my field was all right. I could do that sort of thing quite easily. And I was retrained as a seaplane pilot for the carrier, which was then the air sea rescue aircraft, because we've got helicopters now. And the final Admiralty board was very impressed by the fact that I'd gone back to flying. They thought that bailing out would have been enough to stop anybody. And I said, I didn't think I'd done anything wrong. So I was confident to go back to flying.
So you never flew CFIRES operationally?
No.
Right.
No. as I tell when I tell the funny story, unfortunately the war was over, so I'm not a hero. Everybody thinks that's funny.
And then you spent 2 years as an air sea rescue pilot, would that be roughly
yes,
right?
Yes, it wasn't my prime function on board. I was air gunnery officer because I'd been trained. I'd done it a brief spell in my life, about 3 months at Whale Island. I was also a flight deck officer. I also happened to be a senior watchkeeper, but that was incidental. Except we had this directive from their lordships that air crew were to be integrated into ships. Normal functions. So the captain picked on me very quickly. And said, as a matter of fact, now you're a lieutenant, you're a senior watchkeeping officer. So I had to make out the watchkeeping rosters, not being very good at that moment at navigation myself. But I felt part of the course. And by this, what I thought was the most marvellous stroke of luck was after the first 18 months, the captain was replaced by the captain from Baja.
Ah.
Did I tell you that?
No.
Yes, didn't. Same one. Connolly Ablesmith. He became captain of the Triumph. So he knew me pretty well. And of course he had me in the Bighter for 6 months and several other scars we didn't worry about. But the navigator he asked the ship said, why is it when you're landing on is the only time the captain comes out onto the flying bridge. And he just said, is that sir coming on? And then he said, it's never been for anybody else. And I said, well, he had to fish me out of the sea, the Atlantic once. And he was glad to have me. He said, that's it.
Now, before we, I don't think you've told us the story of when you ditched in the Atlantic. We've heard the story where you ditched in, I say ditched, when you landed in a field in Norfolk.
Ah, yes. But ditching is when I went over the bows when landing on. That's all the same instant.
Ah.
Do you see?
Yes.
Beg your pardon.
Yes, I understand.
I'll tell you what counselling I was given then by the CEO of the squadron. I don't do that again. I can't afford the aircraft. and I flew again the next night as if nothing had happened. And all my subsequent examinings were the Francois, which is the best one to land on. We've had about 6 to choose between. Then that was obviously the ditching incident was in the soldiers' days. And then I was converted like everybody else was in the war and went back to the ship as the gunnery officer, and the commander there said, you are going to be our SU rescue the pilot. I remember saying, as soon as I go to the SU rescue operation, and we've still got aircraft landing on. He said, oh, we've thought of that, we've got another jack. why did I stop flying then? Because the surgeon captain had recognised and through various comments made that I didn't want to fly. And that was enough for him. And I'd been accepted, don't forget the career aspect, I had been accepted for general service then. And the first obligation was to get yourself qualified. Which I did.
Before we move on to your general career and the first lieutenancy of the second, your second first lieutenancy,
yeah,
which is where we came in today. Yeah. Before we move on to that, was it a common event for pilots to reach a point where either they or their captains or the medical officers decided that this particular person had reached a point where he should not fly anymore?
I would say not that they shouldn't fly anymore, but they needed a change. It's more accurate. But I cannot possibly say when that point was. I mean, there were older pilots than me, gosh. Another expression, you may well think, it's fun or not, but it's serious. and I learned this from the Air Force, is they know there are lots of old pilots and there are lots of bold pilots, but no bold old pilots. And of course it's a very, very serious message, because you can get overconfident very, very quickly. And that might show up, the commander and his pilot, or you can lose your confidence going the other way. But I reckon it happened to me, and I've been badly wounded, badly injured. And I suppose I took an easy way out, because I was accepted for general service, and I thought I'd better know something about it. There's quite a lot of other pilots in the same, much the same position as me, being trained in 1940, as I was, and they'd therefore done 6 or 7 years flying, been accepted for general service, and they were desperate to get a